And you're back with Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. A key part of childhood development is learning how to cope with adversity, skills that help children learn healthy responses to the stresses of life. But extreme stress, as in the cases of neglect and trauma, can be so toxic that it actually changes the architecture of the brain.
But science is beginning to show that young brains can be restored with appropriate intervention and care. That's the focus of the third in our continuing WBUR series, Brain Matters, reporting from the front lines of neuroscience.
In a few minutes, we'll talk with the director of Harvard University's Center on the Developing Child. But first, let's listen to an excerpt from WBUR's Iris Adler, who reported this morning on this subject. She begins with the story of a young boy named Peter.
Peter, now 14 years old, was 7 when he was adopted. He'd been living in foster care after being taken from his biological mother. Around the dining table, Peter's family share stories of their son's early life, when he and his siblings endured years of neglect and abuse, living with their biological mother and her violent boyfriend.
It was physical, emotional, continual.
The boyfriend was physically pretty aggressive towards them. On some occasions, forced them to eat chili peppers off the floor.
Peter and his parents, who chose not to use their real names, are very close, but the 7 years since the adoption have been challenging.
He was very sweet and affectionate, and then he would just fall apart and start banging his head against the wall or start screaming, and it seemed to be fear.
Experts have long known that neglect and abuse in early life increase the risk for psychological problems such as depression and anxiety. But now neuroscientists are explaining why, by showing how abuse and neglect wreak havoc on the developing brain, causing physical damage to key brain areas.
So the way we do the EEG is we have these nets of electrodes, and they're sized from little babies up to adults. And when I mentioned changes in technology, this goes on in just a few minutes.
At his lab at Boston Children's Hospital, neuroscientist Charles Nelson studies the effects of early childhood adversity on the brain circuitry.
If I'm being physically abused, sexually abused, emotionally abused, then those circuits become abnormal. And as a result, the brain doesn't wire the right way.
So what prevents the brain from wiring the right way? And how does childhood maltreatment get biologically embedded in the brain? The thinking goes like this. If a child is abused or chronically neglected, it represents a profound threat to the child's existence. That sets off a biological stress response and a flood of hormones, many of which damage critical parts of the brain. Experts call the unremitting stress of abuse and neglect neurotoxic.
Let's say there's 1,000 neurons that are supposed to wire in a certain way. Well, maybe only half of them wire that way, and the other half wire in an incorrect way. So by altering the wiring diagram, you're going to alter behavior and alter psychological states.
But in the year 2000, Dr. Nelson had the opportunity to study a population of neglected children, Romanian orphans raised in harrowing conditions in state orphanages.
Finally, when the kids were 8 to 10, we did magnetic resonance imaging on them, where we could actually look at detailed anatomy in the brains. And that was the most disconcerting, because we found that the kids in the institutional group had much smaller brains, which probably is why they had less brain activity. The question is, why are they small? We're not sure, but probably it's due to a loss of connections and a loss of cells.
This can translate into problems with attention deficit disorder, anxiety disorders, and attachment issues. Dr. Nelson says there are lessons here for American children.
Not surprisingly, kids who grow up in families where there's a lot of maltreatment and then are placed in bad foster care and then one foster care and another, they look just like our kids in Romania. So when people say to me, well, who cares about these children in institutions in Romania? Because it's a model system for what happens in the United States every day.
And Dr. Nelson says it's why scientists must take the emerging science out of the lab and into clinical practice.
That's an excerpt from a report by WBUR's Iris Adler. Hear the full story at our website, radioboston.org. Well, let's turn now for more to Dr. Jack Schoenkopf. He's the director of the Center on the Developing Child at Harvard University. Dr. Schoenkopf, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
So let's pick up right where Iris's report left off. Do we know enough about the effects of profound neglect on developing brains to really take it into clinical practices, into pediatricians' offices about what to do for these children?
Absolutely. I mean, scientists will tell you there's a lot that we don't know, but we know so much more than we're using right now to be able to dramatically change the way we deal with these things preventively in a pediatric office or through our child welfare system. We absolutely know enough to be doing better.
So if you were to, you know, if a pediatrician were to see a child that she might suspect had undergone such profound neglect and abuse, What would she do at the time? Like, what would be the clinical intervention?
Well, for starters, we should really be picking these things up much earlier before we start to see the negative effects. So we know that development is basically interactional. The brain is expecting interaction from the moment of birth. It's this kind of what we call the serve and return interaction between adults and babies. A baby makes a sound, smiles, gurgles. The adult responds back. As the child gets older, an adult does something, the baby responds back. It's this back and forth serve and return interaction that literally shapes and sculpts the architecture of the brain that affects the circuits as they develop. It's not, development is not an automatic pilot. Children don't develop these skills just by kind of doing them on their own. It requires this interaction. And when the brain doesn't get responsive interaction, that signals danger. That is life-threatening. Humans are helpless for a very long period of time. So this is something we should be picking up early and knowing what the signs are of high risk for this situation, a family that's very isolated, that doesn't have supports, that's struggling to keep food on the table, maybe mental illness, maybe substance abuse, all of these things.
I imagine that in and of itself presents quite a conundrum, because the families and the children who are possibly most likely in need of such interventions aren't the ones who are getting regular doctor visits.
Well, we should be really clear.
Am I overreading?
Well, it's a little bit of overreading, but certainly the most disadvantaged families are kind of often out of the mainstream of all services. But there's a real misconception here that children who are neglected because the adults don't care for them, and that's very, very rare. Parents who are neglecting their children love them as much as anyone else, but may be overwhelmed by kind of daily just struggles to get by. And there are lots of ways to pick that up. Most children in the hospital when a child is born, there are factors that can lead us to think, well, this is a family that's isolated, that's struggling. We should look at this more carefully. We can jump on this much earlier than wait for the signs of severe neglect.
Right. Now, in Iris Adler's report, we heard the example of the adoptive family of a young man named Peter who had not only undergone neglect but abuse. I mean, it was a terrible situation that he was in as a young child. I mean, is there any sort of threat? I don't want to say, is there like a bright line in which, you know, now we can officially classify this as the type of neglect that's having architectural effects on the brain. But, you know, for people hearing this, I can imagine that some very, very caring parents are thinking, oh my gosh, maybe I shouldn't let my child cry when he insists that he wants to watch another video.
This is the problem. The answer is not that we have to respond to children every minute of the day. They need to know they're not the only people in the world. Neglect that's a serious problem. Even starts with things like a child who isn't being adequately nourished, who's not gaining weight, a child who may not be adequately bathed, a child whose basic survival needs are not being met. We can pick those signs up early, and we can also know which situations are more likely to produce that kind of difficulty. Depression, which is very common among mothers, and particularly low-income mothers, but not only low-income mothers. Depression is a wonderful example of sometimes being unable to respond to a baby because of your own illness of depression. It has nothing to do with love. We can pick these things up early and get on top of them and prevent the problems rather than try to fix them later.
Now, it seems as if one of the remarkable things about the scientific research here is that showing how early the effects of this neglect and abuse do manifest themselves in an infant's brain. So similarly, is there a point after which it is hard for interventions to undo those effects?
Right. It's a very important question. Early is always better, but it's never too late to be able to improve things. The problem is that the longer you wait, the harder it is to undo some of the physiological disruption, some of the circuitry that's been disrupted. So early is better, but it's never too late. There's a misunderstanding out there of critical periods where the window closes and there's nothing you can do. For the kind of things we're talking about, there is no such thing as never being able to do things later. But you can't get as good an outcome if you start later, and actually you're going to pay more in terms of public services and cost and get less. That's why prevention and early intervention is so important.
Even for in cases where, I mean, as we were hearing earlier in Iris's report, that scientists were finding that the actual size of the infant's brain, right, of the neglected infant's brain, the size of it,
right,
was smaller than a normal child?
Right. So brains, there's variability in size of the, yeah, brains. No question, an abnormally small brain is a brain that's had problems in its development. But brain development has much more to do with circuitry and function than size. It's not true that if you have a bigger brain, you're smarter. It's not just a matter of size. It's a matter of how the brain is wired, how it functions. It's a little bit misleading to just talk about brain size.
Right. And finally, I feel like undergirding this portion of our conversation is this question that was raised in Iris's report, the part that we heard, that perhaps now we can't think of the effects of neglect and abuse as something out there in Romanian orphanages, that there's a moral imperative to look out for these things in children across the United States.
Absolutely, and to recognize that when we talk about maltreatment in children, we're talking about both overt abuse and neglect, and that, in fact, the visible signs of physical abuse, like fractures and injuries that you can see, may in the long run have less consequences than the invisible things that you can't see that affect how the brain is developing, how a child is able to regulate emotions, how a child is able to kind of solve problems, understand things. So it's really understanding how much that serve and return interaction is critical to healthy brain development from the beginning.
Well, Dr. Jack Schoenkopf is director of the Center on the Developing Child at Harvard University. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And listeners, remember, you can hear WBUR's Brain Matter series. There's a link to it at our website, radioboston.org.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.